Yo, what's up, guys? JB here. Today is February 20th, 2010. It's a Saturday night, which means it is a Saturday night contest tonight. Tonight's event is a roundtable discussion. We've done a lot of these over the past 2.5 years on the website with a lot of different artists. And tonight, joining me is Jason England. Jason, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. How about me?
Yes, you can hear me beautifully. Jason, just so that you guys know, he's on his cell phone right now, so if his sound sounds a little bit buggy or worse than mine, it's not because his voice sounds any less seductive than mine in real life. It's just the cell phone.
Or so I'm glad we cleared that up.
Yeah, or so he claims. We've got a lot of questions. We've got around 20 minutes or so. We're going to get to as many as we possibly can tonight that you guys have posted. We asked you to post any question you wanted. You had a limit of 3 questions per member, and a lot of you, most of you, used up all 3. So we're going to go through as many as possible. We're going to try to pick out the best of the best questions in our judgment, and we'll start this off. Right now, I think there's a good question. The very first post that is in... the forum thread is asking, how many books do you own on the subject of gambling, magic, and general card skills? And before you get to this question, I kind of wanted to have you talk about your philosophy on books versus video training in general, because there's a lot of posts in the forums. Every time we release a move like the push-off second deal, they're like, this is in Expert at the Card Table. So what's your position on that before you talk about what is in your personal library?
Well, first of all, you used the phrase that I've used in the past and a lot of people use, but it's a phrase that I actually object to on the surface. And it's the phrasing of books versus video. I've used that phrase before. I think we've all used that phrase. And if we haven't used it, we've read about it, we've thought about it. But really, isn't that the wrong way to put it? Because the world doesn't ask us to choose one over the other. So books versus DVDs or books versus video is an artificial constraint. It's books and video and personal instruction and self-exploration and, you know, things you stumble across on the internet or that someone tells you. It's not one versus the other. So are there terrific things on video, DVD, the internet? Of course there are. Are there terrific things in books? Absolutely. So that's the first thing is I think let's be careful with our language. And, you know, like I said, I've used that before, but I try to remind myself that it isn't one thing versus another. It's where can we learn from and where can we not learn from? And the truth is we can learn from all of those sources. So as far as my personal library goes, I don't have an actual count in my head. I have an Excel spreadsheet where I keep every book and, you know, item of some value in it for insurance purposes that I then email to myself every, you know, so often. I would say in the magic world, it's somewhere around, you know, 1,000 books. If you count the gambling things, it's probably another 500 or so. If you include stuff like math books, you know, I've got a lot of Martin Gardner books that have magic-y things in them, but I don't necessarily consider those magic books. If you allow me to include my math books that have some sort of interesting probability chapter or, you know, there's a cool Martin Gardner-esque chapter in them, now we're probably up in the neighborhood of, 2,000 or so. So that's the answer to how many books I have.
A lot is the answer to the question.
A lot. Yeah, it fills an entire room, and I've got boxes in the garage.
No, I like your response about the books and DVDs type thing, because if you think about it, let's say all video form or modern television turns 3D 5-10 years from now, 20 years from now, that'll be a new way to learn stuff. All right, in 3D through CGI or something. And that could be in addition to videos, that could be in addition to books, and that could be in addition to magazines where you might learn something, trade magazines or websites, etc. So it's not someone saying in the response to the push-off second deal, oh, this is an Expert at the Card Table. Yeah, and...
Right, you know, it's something, you know, people that say things like, you don't have to spend money on this, it's in such and such book, which you probably already own. Well, on the face of it, they're absolutely right. You don't have to spend money on it, you do have the information there. But that's like saying, you know, if you want to play guitar like Eddie Van Halen, all you have to have is a guitar and an amp and maybe a couple of effects pedals. And it's true that that's basically all he has once he's up there. And if you struggle long enough and hard enough, you may eventually achieve the same kind of talent that he's got. But wouldn't it be a lot smarter to have one or two or five or 15 great music coaches that were helping to guide you over, you know, the 20 years that it might take you to achieve the kind of prowess that an Eddie Van Halen has? Well, of course it would. You know, it doesn't mean you can't get there by yourself. But if you want to speed along the process, you should pay attention to people that have walked that path before you. So if I hand you The Expert at the Card Table and half a dozen other really good books, could you eventually become a world-class card magician? Yes, you could. But it might take you 20 years, whereas if you work a little bit smarter versus working a little bit harder, you might get there in 10 years or 8 years or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're right, but I think they're missing the bigger picture, which is what's the best way to get from A to B, not what is a way to get from A to B.
Correct. No, and I think it's also a good point that no matter how... no matter how good you are, there's still ways that you can improve or things you can learn from hearing someone else that's experienced. Even if they're equally as experienced as you, learning about someone else's pitfalls or a story they might have or a tip they might have on a move could still, like every NBA team is full of great, great players, but even the Chicago Bulls in their prime still had a coach. So there are still ways that,
that
they were still improving and needed guidance. The next question here I see from Lyle Borders, post number 6. He's asking basically about your story. He says, no one's magically born a card sharp. How did you gain your interest? So what's your overall story of how you got, in a nutshell, from A to Z?
Well, you know, it was about 20 years ago, and the truth is I don't really remember exactly what sparked my interest in those things. I just sort of have some vague memories and vague feelings. I can tell you that the very first book on any subject, gambling, magic, or, you know, related subject that I ever bought was not a magic book. It was actually a gambling book. It was a book called Playing Blackjack as a Business by a guy named Lawrence Revere, and it was a book that taught you how to count cards at blackjack. I bought that when I was 18 or 19 years old because a casino had recently opened in Tunica, Mississippi, which was about an hour's drive from my grandmother's house, and I knew she liked to play blackjack. So even though I wasn't actually old enough to play, I thought, wow, I can buy this book and then I can learn to get really good at this game, and in a year or two when I'm old enough to go in and play blackjack with her, I'll be very good at the game. Well, that was the plan of an 18 or 19-year-old. It didn't quite work out that way, but it was sort of the thing that sparked my interest in gambling books. Very shortly after that, maybe 6 months after that, 8 months after that, I started buying sleight-of-hand magic books and kind of went from there. So my interest was from a very early age.
Okay, it's a good next question that is a good follow-up to that last one. He's asking, how do you feel about branching out in magic? The guy's name is True to Coins. He says, it seems from what we've seen from you thus far, cards are what you do. That's what you do specifically. Have you ever done or do you do any money magic, any other genres of magic, manipulation, maybe rubber bands, As my note, you know, I've seen your library. You've got books on scams and cons and a lot of other subjects that are not just magic books in your library. What other things of interest or any other areas of magic that you've ever been interested in, or has it always been cards?
Cards were there from the very beginning, but I'm interested in all types of other magic. But I don't necessarily practice to the point of performance other types of magic. You know, I've been interested in mentalism. I've been interested in classic close-up magic like the cups and balls, and I've owned a set of linking rings since I was a kid. You know, I went through the phase where I bought everything at the magic shop like most people do, and all of it intrigues me on some level. However, for whatever reason, the cards are what I really was attracted to the most, and they're the things that I, you know, spend 99% of my time on to this day. But, you know, I'm well versed, at least in book form, I'm well versed in all sorts of other magic. I don't perform it, and I don't practice it all that much, you know, a little bit here and there. You know, if you ask me about a trick that's not magic, I will almost certainly know what you're talking about and be able to talk about the trick on some level. And the only exception to that would be grand illusion. You know, you ask me about stage illusions, I may not know very much at all. But the rest of that stuff, I've read about and I've played with it, and you know, I probably have a working knowledge of the method, even if I, you know, have never performed it or given it a lot of practice time.
Correct. And you probably do have expertise on any Grand Illusion that has been in the Copperfield show in the past 5 years, during which time you've probably watched it 30 to 40,000 times.
Well, yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny. I don't exactly know how all of those things work. I have vague ideas on how they work. But the truth is they don't interest me all that much. Probably because I never get close enough to be able to feel like I could really understand them or know about them. So, you know, I know how, oh, probably 80% of the Grand Illusion that I work, or that I see works. I know how it, you know, on a basic level, how it operates. But, you know, I still get fooled pretty bad, you know, one trick in five if I'm watching someone like a Steinmeier or a Copperfield or, you know, someone like that, just because I don't have that background information.
There's another post by Perceptive 3 Card Magic, post number 14. He's saying, you have a lot of books. You have so many books. I envy you for it. What are some great books that you haven't read yet that you really want to get your hands on? Is there anything that's on your wish list or on your to-do list this year or just at some point that you really want to see?
Well, first of all, I'm going to steal a line from Byron Walker. Byron Walker owns arguably the largest magic book collection in English. Byron lives in San Leandro, California. And when you see Byron's books, and he has no idea how many he has, but they cover every inch of his house, and you ask him, have you read all of these? Byron has a terrific line. He says, I've read all of some of them and some of all of them. And that's sort of the position I find myself in. I mean, if you look around my library, many of those books I've read cover to cover. Some of them I only got, you know, halfway through before I got sidetracked or distracted by something and I never went back to it. Some of them weren't worth finishing, to be honest. So there's books in my own library that I would like to read or reread or, you know, go back over certain sections. But as far as books that I don't have, you know, I could probably sit down and make a list of 10 or 15 right off the top of my head. I mean, there'd be things like rereading the entire Tarbell series, I think would be a terrific education. Something I probably did in piecemeal section over the years, but never sat down and read them all over a period of, say, a month or two. That would be something that I think would be very worthwhile. I'm constantly rereading Erdnase. I have a very high tolerance for that book. I never get tired of reading it. I hope that answers the question. There's not too much stuff out there in the world that I'm dying to get my hands on, and I just can't, with the exception of a couple of rare antique books. But that, I think that goes beyond what the original poster was sort of asking there.
Right. Next question is a very specific question. It's by PopChris3. His post number is 15. He's asking, do you prefer the strike or the push-off second deal? Which is interesting because we had the strike deal put up a few months ago. We just now posted the push-off second deal. If you want to tell them a little bit about, you know, why we put up the strike first, why we posted the second, pros and cons of either, and obviously the strike's not found in Expert at the Card Table. Push-off second is. So which one's easier? What are your feelings on the two?
Well, they are, you know, they're both great moves. And if you were an absolute master of either one of them, I don't think you would find necessarily that one outshone the other necessarily. Having said that, I think it's easier to become very good at a strike second than it is to become very good at a push-off second. I think the strike second is a little bit easier. The truth is both moves are difficult, but if you forced me to answer, I'd say the strike was a little bit different, or a little bit less difficult. Now then, as to which one I prefer, the truth is I don't have an overall preference. I learned both because I have uses for both that I touch on very briefly in the push-off second deal one-on-one. If you told me to deal around in a circle in a rapid-fire format like a game of blackjack dealt out of the hand, I would choose a strike second deal every time. If you told me to count down 10 cards and deal a second all 10 times very quickly into a pile like in a magic trick, I would choose the strike second deal every time. But if you told me to deal a single second, I have to take the top card, deal it forward, towards a spectator, and in that action I can only deal 1 second, it's got to be the first card off the top of the deck, I would almost certainly choose a push-off second deal in that scenario, And the truth is, I'd probably do it from a break to ensure that I nailed a really tight push-off. So I don't have a favorite. I use, you know, the proper tool for whatever the task at hand is.
Here's a different type of question. Next up, the post guy is wilder each day, which is interesting. So he's getting wilder each day. His post number is 18. He says he's fairly new to magic. I purchased several of your videos and attempted to learn the sleights. I'm still having a bit of trouble. What progression in learning the techniques would you recommend in terms of difficulty in building of mechanical movements? Or in slightly less confusing terms, which of the sleights in particular that you've taught so far would you recommend someone starting off with first, if any?
Well, assuming that you've got a basic knowledge of how to, you know, hold a deck of cards, deal a deck of cards, shuffle a deck of cards, I would always choose the moves that had the most utility. And, for those of you that don't know what utility is, it just means the most bang for your buck. Take a move like the Greek deal or the center deal. Those are very, very specialized moves. And even though I've been doing them for years, I don't do them that often, and most of the time that I do them, they're actually demo moves. I'm not using them as secret sleights. So they don't have a high level of utility. They're, you know, they're moves that you do just because you can and you show them to people. Whereas a move like the bottom deal or the second deal has a high degree of utility, a high amount of utility, because you can use them as secret sleights or you could demonstrate them, and they're much more versatile. A move like a push-through shuffle or a zero shuffle has even more utility because you can use them constantly over and over and over as secret sleights, and it really helps convince your spectators that a selected card or a group of selected cards are completely lost in the deck. You know, palming has an unbelievable amount of utility to it because you can just do so much. You couldn't list all the things you can do with palming. It would take you forever. So for the beginners, I would say, ignore the crazy moves like the McMillan turnover switch. Ignore the center deal. Ignore the Greek deal. Those are very specialized moves that we put out for a small group of guys that either wanted to see them or that were ready for them. The beginners and even the intermediate guys, you need to concentrate on push-through shuffle, zero shuffle, palming, second deal, bottom deal.
Double lift.
And double lift. Double lift. I forgot about that one because that's a new one. But absolutely. And the double lift. Those are the moves that have, you know, tremendous amounts of utility, and you'll use them for the rest of your life in every single performance, as opposed to a center deal, which I only show to people typically when they ask or if I'm doing a gambling expose ask.
There's a next question I'm seeing here, talking about sleights that you don't use that much. There's a question by Movies and Magic 3. I'm guessing he likes movies and magic. He says, are there any sleights that you prefer to practice on your own for fun but rarely show to spectators? If so, which? So is there anything that you just find yourself playing with over and over again but not really ever using? Or is that fall into the category of like the Greek deal or the center deal?
Well, no, I use the Greek and center deal in performance, and I have used them as secret sleights. I just don't do it very often. I get the feeling that this question is more like, are there any moves that I almost never use in real performance,
correct,
but that I sit at home and practice? And the answer is yes, there's dozens of them. One that comes to mind is Charlie Miller's table pass from Di Vernon's Ultimate Card Secrets. Other moves are things like the free turn pass that Bruce Servan put in Ultra Servan. You know, there's all sorts of moves in Ernest Eric's book that I love to play with and I have fun experimenting with and I practice them all the time, but I either don't think they're up to speed for laymen or I have better workarounds or a different workaround that for whatever reason I'm choosing over the move in question. The diagonal palm shift is a move that I don't use very often, but there are at least two tricks that I can think of right off the top of my head where I virtually have to use that move, and so I will use it in performance. But, you know, I don't use the diagonal palm shift in every performance. It's just something that, you know, it's a very specific tool, and I use it for a very specific set of circumstances. But, you know, so, yeah, there's dozens of them. I could probably make a list of 10 or 20 that I play with. You know, Larry Jennings' one-handed bottom palm is a move I've played with for years. I don't think I've ever done it in performance because while I think it's a really cool piece of engineering, I don't have any reason to palm from the bottom with one hand that I can't, you know, accomplish in some other way.
I know we have only have a few more minutes here, so I'm trying to wrap this up, but also get to any of the remaining really, really good questions that I think a lot of people would benefit from and be interested in. There's a question by Industrial Child, his post number is 34, and he's asking about your friend, a guy I've met once, but obviously an unbelievable card handler, Steve Forte. He says, what is it like learning from the man himself, Steve Forte? I cannot even fathom that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I consider myself extremely privileged to have had the opportunity to spend basically the last, you know, 3 years living 2 miles away from Steve and seeing him, you know, sometimes 3 and 4 days a week. He's taught me more in these 3 years than I could have learned in, you know, in 10 years by myself, which just goes to show you the power of finding a good, you know, mentor, someone that's far ahead of you on the path. You know, and I mean, he's shown me things that I didn't think were possible. He's shown me things that I knew were possible, but I didn't think could look as good as he made them look. And he's given me some terrific advice, as far as the best way to, proceed down a given career path or the best way to do a certain move. You know, he gave me a lifetime's, worth of lessons in gambling collectibles, which is a field that, you know, the average Theory 11 person probably thinks I'm an expert in, and the truth is that I consider myself a babe in the woods in that world, because I learn stuff about it every single day. And most of that, I'd say a good 90% of it, all that information is coming from Steve in one way, shape, or form, whether he told me directly or whether he just recommended some good books to go out and get. So, you know, it's unbelievable. I feel like Sir Vaughan and Jennings must have felt when they landed at the Magic Castle in the mid-60s and had Vernon, you know, right there every single night at the castle. I mean, I feel like that has to be what it must have been like. Or the Chicago guys that had Marlowe for all those years, or the guys that have Roy Walton to this very day teaching them things. I mean, these guys are, you know, for all their faults and for all their little, you know, their idiosyncrasies, these guys are the giants, and, you know, for better or for worse. And so I consider myself very fortunate.
We'll get to one or two more here, and here's one I see coming up a lot. We have all these moves out, especially from you, in the one-on-one section, that are moves, like the bottom deal, the center deal, Greek deal, everything like that. We teach them a lot of moves. Some of these videos we've released thus far have some sample applications in them, but a lot of people wonder, how do you combine these gambling moves specifically into a routine? So there's a post by 17, his post number is 41. He's saying, what resources would you recommend in learning effect construction or routine construction? And so he could put together these slights into one routine.
Well, the first thing I would say is that I don't construct a lot of routines from the ground up. You know, almost everything I do is a variation of something I've read somewhere, something someone's shown me, something that, you know, I ran across on a DVD that I bought or something like that. So if you ask me to count the routines that I've come up with completely from scratch, I mean, you could count on the fingers of one hand. It's just not that many. So if you're interested in gambling routines, I would look towards people that have done gambling routines and published them. You want to look for Martin Nash. You want to look for Darwin Ortiz, who, interestingly enough, I'm about to pick up from the Las Vegas airport in about 5 minutes. I'm actually in the parking garage of the airport right now, and Darwin's plane just landed. You know, so you want to look for Martin Nash, Darwin Ortiz. You know, you want to look for things from other people that have published gambling stuff, like Jack Carpenter, Jim Swain. And if the routine that you read isn't exactly your cup of tea, but you like the basic effect, maybe it uses a move that you're not familiar with or you don't feel like you do well, then alter it. Try to come up with a workaround while still preserving whatever it was that attracted you to the routine in the first place. And you go from there. And I still consider myself a student in this area. You know, I constantly try to add original things to routines, but it's extremely difficult. You know, so I depend on, you know, on a lot of different sources to give me ideas that then I can try to modify and suit to my own tastes and desires and abilities and things of that nature.
There's a good last question here, and I'll let you go pick him up from the airport. The question's by Spade444. It's on page 6. It's post number 51. And it's kind of a vague question, but it's a good thing to cap this off. And he's saying, is there any way that you think the Magic community, or which ways specifically, do you think the Magic community could be improved? Is it relations between the older generation and newer generation? Is it the time it takes before a trick should be put on the market? What do you think is, you know, a few things that you see that are actually possible and not just theoretical that could really benefit this industry or the people within it?
I think I saw this question before we started talking, JB, right before I left the house. I don't know if I saw it or not, but I certainly saw a question like that. And I thought about it. I thought it was a great question. And I think the one thing that has been removed from Magic in the last, 10 years or so was the filtering element of A, brick and mortar Magic shops. You know, that crusty old guy behind the counter that's seen it all, done it all. He's gone these days, by and large. For the most part, the brick and mortar Magic shops with the grand old man standing behind the counter are long gone. And the other thing that's missing is now the publishing methodologies used to act as a filter, because in 1980, if you wanted to put out a book, you had to take it to someone that did that sort of thing for a living. And if they looked at it and said, this is terrible, you're not going to sell 3 copies, well, you knew you had to go back to the drawing board. The publishing house became the filter, keeping a lot of the junk from flooding the market. And a lot of times the guys publishing the books were the grand old men standing behind the counter at a Magic shop somewhere. So that filtering element is now gone, because anyone can publish a pamphlet. You know, desktop publishing allows anyone to print up their own books and have Lulu.com crank out a million of them. Anyone can videotape and edit their own videos and DVDs these days. I mean, if you tried to do that in 1980, it was possible, but it was extremely hard to do, especially to do it well. And so that filtering element is gone. Now anyone can flood the market with junk. So if you're conscientious and you want to make great products and you want to do a good job, you have to figure out a way of putting those filters back into your life. You need, what Michael Weber, refers to as a brain trust. And it's a phrase that he didn't invent, but I certainly picked it up from him, so I'll give him credit for, making me aware of that phrase, if not the concept. A brain trust is a group of guys that you depend on to give you honest, intelligent feedback. And, if you're, 35 to 55 or 65 years old, you've been doing Magic for 40 years, you probably got 50 guys you can depend on and trust. If you're 13 years old and you've been doing Magic for 6 months or 4 years or something like that, you may not have a lot of those people surrounding you these days, especially in this internet world, where these filters have started to drop by the wayside. And my advice to you is get that brain trust. Get those filters back into your life. You want someone that won't look at something and say, hey, that's really cool, when it's not. You know, you want someone to say, hey, that's a great idea, but you know what? It was published 30 years before you were born. So while you do it well, it's not original. You need that kind of, that kind of brain trust and that kind of filter in your life to make sure that you don't waste people's time, make sure you don't waste your own time, make sure that you stay on the path doing, doing moves properly and learning and understanding and all of that stuff. And the last thing I would say on this is don't depend on anonymous morons on the internet to be part of your brain trust. You want real people that give you their real name, that give you their credentials, and that tell you why they're worth listening to. So I think posting video clips on YouTube asking for comments is perhaps the least productive thing you could ever do in your life. What you should do is you should make 5 copies of that video, send it to 5 well-posted magicians that you trust and know, and then listen to them. But, posting videos on YouTube or posting videos on a site and say, hey guys, what do you think? Give me some feedback, is not only not productive, I think it's counterproductive, because you're just going to get a barrage of comments, and now you're trying to filter out the good from the bad, and you're right back where you started from. Surround yourself with people that will only give you intelligent comments, and you save a whole lot of time that you can then use watching my one-on-ones.
No, I think it's a good point. If you think about if doctors didn't have to go to medical school and then they just asked random people what should you do if you have massive blood loss, you get a lot of different opinions on what that person thinks you do. But luckily there's a medical school element that everyone has to pass a certain bar. If you're a lawyer, you have to pass a bar in order to have some qualification, and Magic doesn't have that. So posting it on YouTube is kind of like asking the largely uneducated masses what their thoughts are, which quite frankly, probably don't matter. They're going to tell you no, the obvious. Yeah, they don't. So.
Well, they typically don't matter. And even if one or two guys were trying to say something intelligent, those comments are lost in a sea of ridiculous comments from people that don't know what the hell they're looking at in the first place.
Right. No,
so, yeah, it's counterproductive, and it's a waste of your filming time. It's a waste of your setup and editing time. It's a waste of your upload time. All of that time could be better spent just practicing something a lot more and then showing it to a lot fewer people that you hand select.
No, I think the filtering element is correct. You talked about it being used to be the publishing company, and I find us, you know, we really do try to be that that intermediary between artists, and because some of the artists that we deal with don't have that, you know, that really close-knit people around them necessarily to see something. So they send stuff to us saying, what do you think of this? Knowing that we're going to send this to guys like you, Jason, or Chris, or a lot of the other guys on our team that will tell you unsugarcoated what they think of something or if they've seen it before, et cetera. So I think, you know, we're having to become that a little bit just because we have eyes on quality over quantity, but not every company does. So it is a ongoing problem of companies just putting out stuff because they can. So that's obviously something that's not going to be solved very soon. But anyway, we'll wrap this up. I think that was the last question. Jason's got to go pick up someone from the airport, so we're going to let him go. And thanks for recording this. Guys, if you ask any other questions in this thread, we'll try to get him in front of Jason. And if he has time later tonight, maybe, or tomorrow, to come back in the thread and answer any lingering questions that are particularly important, we'll do so. But thank you, Jason, for doing this. And we'll chat with you
soon. Thank you, JB.
Thanks.
All right, talk to you. Bye.